First company I ever started was when I was 14 years old. I made a CD for a friend of mine. I really didn't want to do it, so I said $300 a CD, and people started buying them, landscaping. Sold that when I was 17 to a landscaping company. She wanted me to be a pastor. I did not. Long story short, when I was 17, I ended up homeless. Went on for about 4 years. I fought between getting odd jobs and being homeless. I got really bored with my business classes. I decided to open up a cigar lounge. I took what furniture I had left in my college apartment, the last $5,000 I had in my pocket, and I rented out a little space, threw all my furniture in there, and bought 4 boxes of cigars because that's all I had money for. Sell those 4 boxes as fast as possible. Sold them, bought 8. Sold those 8, bought 16. Sold 16, bought 32. Ended up becoming investors, and we were able to grow out the business. I gave up way too much equity for growth. These are very seasoned business people, and I was probably a little more chicken shit than I should have been.
I didn't want to grow up to have a job that I would be stressing. Creating basketball cards. I was big into like the WWF action figures, so I'd be on the bus doing this, making deals with kids before school. Friends and I, we would play tennis, built this tournament within the town that got up to about 40 guys at the high school. If somebody doesn't say there's no chance of them doing something, I will look for any kind of way to convince them to do what I think they should do. Who said they would never do it, to actually go and go skydiving. And they loved it. I was a sports management major. Went to Seton Hall internships. One of them was working at Madison Square Garden.
There you go.
I always wanted to work for the Knicks. I did advertising sales there. After I graduated college, I began working for the New York Mets. My real love for sales, I guess, truly started because I would go into the office there and make 120 cold calls and found that I was good at it. Started working for a ticket broker company in the city. Worked my way up to be a supervisor.
Boring being a manager?
No, I actually liked it a lot more. I actually interviewed Todd and we started to work really well together.
Good cop and you're the bad cop.
I would flip that around.
I know.
He left me. He abandoned me. Couldn't really move up the ladder too much anymore. I kept tossing the idea back and forth between all different friends and family. Eventually got to Todd and tossed the idea by him. You haven't shut up about this for the last 4 months. Like, yeah. Either do something about it or stop talking about it. And that's really kind of what gave me the kick in the butt to start taking this seriously.
Hey, I have this weird idea. What do you think? And I'm like, that's a really cool idea. You should do something with that. Is him saying, do you want to jump on board? Because he could really use, extra set of hands.
Everything I could do without Todd's help, I would just make my way up and down 9th Avenue and pop into restaurants and say, hey, would you be willing to give those people I send to you something small on your menu? And once I got that, positive affirmation, I figuring out how to develop this into a functional app. All you need to do is select a few appetizers, sides, desserts, whatever it is you want to feature, and let us put that on the app. When one of our users goes to the restaurant, they sit down, they have to order more. They can't just go in and get their free thing and leave. Users spend $10 a month, and then they can get up to one appetizer on the house every single day.
A lot of this past year has been heavily focusing on revamping what the app looks like and what the experience for the user looks like as well. App is free to use until September. So if you download it, all you have to do is register with an email or Facebook, and you get a free appetizer once per day, every day, at any of the partner restaurants.
A ton of restaurants that I'm really excited about.
Sensacana,
yeah, that's always a
first. Well, one of the best California rolls in the city, because they actually use real snow crab, not that fake shit.
Le Ravage
on Restaurant Row. Amazing French bistro. They actually won best burger in New York City for the French onion soup burger. Perua, which is an Uruguayan restaurant. I love South American food. Steak there is to die for, absolutely to die for. Fantastic ambiance. I like it because it's nice open, like window style. Tons of places with amazing food close up every day.
It's indeed.
Obika, mozzarella bar. They are something else. They have actually 24 different locations. Complimentary fresh mozzarella balls over there, which I've had. And they're delicious.
I recently did a public crowdfunder.
Money to continue operations while we're building out everything and doing a lot of the testing. We're gonna look at equity crowdfunding. With a WeFunder, you're investing where you get equity. At our non-New Yorkers are asking us when we're expanding out, which was great. Big one for us right now is launching our new version in September. Looking at other cities down the road.
Food influencers on Instagram.
Yep. Some of the food influencers is we have a specific package where if they make warm intros to restaurants for us, if Nick closes them, we give them a payout. We saw a 280% increase in unique appetizer redemptions. So a lot of our customer acquisition right now has been two things. One, we talk to people. And two, we run events at our partner restaurants where people sign up and get a free appetizer right then and there. And a lot of restaurants,
we encourage people to go to the same restaurants over and over if they've found a spot that they really like.
Tech still being done in San Diego?
No, we actually have a guy we work with out of WeWork Labs.
And did he take equity or are you paying him?
Both. My biggest pet peeves, they're building something to get bought and not building something to build. I believe that building out your supply end first is the most important part.
Oh, I've grown. I mean, really just understanding, you know, the time that it takes to build something like this. It requires hustle and grind every single day.
You can't learn how to clear your head. The downs will kill you. Highs are great, the lows are really low.
Yes.
I mean, how many times I buried myself in a pillow, thought I was gonna fucking fail. I cried myself to sleep and you just wake up, clear your mindset and go back at it. Because
hello, startup hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
While everything might go wrong, it's on you to turn it back around. On the iOS store, APP, APP, no space, no nothing. You'll see it. We're a nice little orange logo with an A and a fork in it. Download it, register, get your free appetizers.
New York City only for now. Welcome to Startup Hunter, also streaming on YouTube. I'm here with Nick and Todd from AppApp, which is this really cool program to give you free appetizers at restaurants here in New York City. And it's just starting. They're picking up momentum. But what I do on this show is we take a little dive back into your history of entrepreneurship. So we're going to start with Nick, since he is the CEO, right?
Nope.
Nope. I'm the CEO.
CEO.
But he's the original founder.
COO.
Okay. So yeah, so that was the thing. So there was a confusion there. So we're going to start with Todd. Because I start with the CEO first. And that's totally getting left in because this show is sort of like comedians in cars getting coffee for startups.
No edits. No edits.
Oh, yeah, that show is not edited at all. They shoot for a day and boil it down to 15 minutes. I just need a budget for boats and helicopters. So, Todd Fulk, I met you in New York City, you know, a few months ago, and you were telling me about this thing, and I was like, okay. But then I found out you had this extremely interesting entrepreneurial history. And where were you born, Todd? And what did your parents do?
Oh, fantastic question. So I'm technically adopted. So I believe my birth, I was born in Pennsylvania, lived in Miami. My father owned his own car dealership. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Eventually they got divorced. Growing up, not a strong childhood.
What was the first entrepreneurial thing you ever did? Did you sell seashells by the seashore in Miami? Like,
the first company I ever started was when I was 14 years old. So I made a CD for a friend of mine who was like learning to do DJ stuff at a radio station.
Yeah.
And this is around the time where like MP3s and everything were getting a little bit popular. So I just put a whole shitload of like cool sounds and stuff on a CD for him.
Yes.
And I ended up giving it to him as a gift. He loved it. Showed it to all of his friends and all the guys at the station, and they loved it. So they asked me, they would like one as well. And I'm like, yeah, cool. And he's like, how much? And I said, I really didn't want to do it. So I said $300 a CD. And people started buying them.
Wait. $300 for
a CD.
About
350 unique sound effects.
Yeah.
A good chunk of them I made myself. Some I found on the internet, all in MP3 format. But this was around a time when like
Napster.
Before. A little bit before. But sound effects were like really not super easy to get a hold of.
Yeah.
Especially for like radios and DJ stations and stuff like that. So just having 350 right there, super easy to pull and throw into your sets, was very, very convenient.
I love it. So you're like a little music licensing service, totally analog and organic. And so what happened with that? Did it become something, or did it sort of peter off?
So after about 6 months, I got an offer and I ended up selling it for about, let's say a reasonable size of money for a 14-year-old.
Yeah. Like $10,000.
A little more reasonable than that.
Okay.
Then the next thing I ended up doing was starting a landscaping.
Yes. Lots of people on the show have done landscaping.
Yeah, so you do that. I found out I hated doing it, so mowed a bunch of yards, and I ended up shifting it to having my friends do it. I just went around and got yards and just did that. Sold that when I was 17 to a landscaping company, and long story short, after that, ran into a fun snafu. My mom and I had a big disagreement about what I wanted to do with my life.
Sure.
And
what did she want you to do?
She wanted me to be a pastor.
Wow.
I did not.
Sure.
She wanted me to be a pastor. I did not. So long story short, when I was 17, I ended up homeless while I was still in high school.
Yeah.
So I slept in a parking garage for a good chunk of the remainder of my high school career. And for the off and on for about 4 years, I fought between getting odd jobs and being homeless. After about 4 years, I was able to save up enough money to start to put myself through college.
Wow. Where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Kutztown in Pennsylvania. It's a state school right between Reading and Allentown, Pennsylvania.
And what'd you study?
I have a degree in finance and international business.
So knowing you, you've already had entrepreneurial experiences under your belt. You must have done something in college.
During my senior year in college, I got really bored with my business classes. I decided to open up a cigar lounge.
Yes.
Main reason for that was...
In Kutztown.
Yep. Main reason for that was purely because...
Show everyone the cigar. You started your cigar bar in Kutztown.
Yeah, I started in Kutztown mainly because me and a group of friends, we all smoked at this one bar, and then all of a sudden they made it illegal to smoke in bars.
Yeah.
So we're like, well, this sucks. This is our Wednesday and Thursdays. Like, this is how we would relax. So I took what furniture I had left in my college apartment, the last $5,000 I had in my pocket, and I rented out a little space, threw all my furniture in there, and bought 4 boxes of cigars, because that's all I had money for.
Yeah.
And I remember I just went everywhere, and the whole goal was sell those 4 boxes as fast as possible. Sold them, bought 8. Sold those 8, bought 16. Sold 16, bought 32. And steadily just built it up. Almost a year into doing everything, some of my customers became very interested and ended up becoming investors, and we were able to grow out the business from there.
So talk about the growth. What was your second store?
Second store was Reading, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Grew that out. At that point, we were able to obtain liquor licenses.
Oh, so you were running a cigar bar without a liquor license?
No. The first one was a cigar store.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the first one was a cigar store. After that, we were able to get liquor licenses to build cigar bars. Did that for about 4.5 years.
Uh-huh.
Ended up having to fire sell those.
Why did you have to fire sell them?
So the reason we ended up fire selling is the FDA wanted to start treating cigars like cigarettes.
Yeah.
And all of our assets were tobacco and alcohol, right? One of the major rules that they were looking to enforce was you cannot have tobacco and alcohol in the same premise.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking at it on investment end and our business end and saying if this actually hits, and if you were looking at the political landscape at the time. So we were looking at it and saying if this passes, we're pretty much bankrupt overnight. So we thought it'd be better just to sell everything and just cash out where we could. Even though it was a fire sale, we really didn't lose. Some of us made a little bit.
So, but today, I mean, did that ever go through, or have cigar bars been able to have alcohol in them?
So that part never passed. Neither did the walk-in humidor, which is a big fear. Ultimately, what ended up happening was they just jacked up taxes again.
So do you think if you held on to the businesses, you would have done better, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. And so just talk about the scale of your cigar empire. Didn't you have one in Philly?
No.
Ah.
We were from ABE through Harrisburg.
Got it. So
Never wanted to touch...
Central Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Never wanted to touch Bethlehem at all because too many huge players were there. You have like Cigars International, you have Famous, Smoke Shop.
So you were really going around the edges.
Yeah. And like in Philadelphia, you have like Holtz. Just really, really, really big players.
Sure.
And there was a huge glut in like the middle.
Yeah. Very interesting. So you found some low-hanging fruit. You found an opportunity.
Pretty much.
And as I recall now, you moved to New York after that.
Correct.
You go get a job because you don't know anybody in New York.
Yep.
One thing I would do drastically different, and something I've learned very fast, is I gave up way too much equity for growth.
Uh-huh.
So I barely owned anything. by the end of it all.
Yeah.
I worked most of the hours, but I owned almost nothing.
So how do you, you know, it's a negotiation. You know, how do you value what your value of the company is going to be, A? And at the same time, if somebody wants to invest, how do you negotiate with them so that you get them on board, but don't give away too much?
So one of the biggest things that was probably killing me early on was I didn't have a huge back history with it. Like, even when we were growing, it was, I had one small store, then two, then three. Like, while they were doing well, I'm still like not an industry veteran, and a lot of people who were investing in were people who looked to grow like their local areas. So like, they had the contacts I needed. They had all the chips, and it was, in some of the scenarios, it was like, yeah, they would love to do it. It's just, I'm that extra benefit because I have some experience, but like, it wasn't weighted as much. And to be very frank, what's the best way to put it? These are very seasoned business people, and I was probably a little more chicken shit than I should have been.
Yeah, it's great, great lessons.
Absolutely.
Now you're probably a little tougher because of it.
That's what I'm aiming for, yeah.
So you come to New York, you get a job, you work for 3 years, sales guy, right?
So yeah, and this is where Nick and I met. I worked for a company called Cater to Me. Nick will have a field day telling about that story as well. I worked there for about, 9, 10 months? Ended up leaving there, getting a better offer with another company. Pretty much just jumped around for like corporate catering startups and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Eventually just started doing freelance work in CRM development, because it's easier in the terms of I determine my own hours and the pay was pretty good.
So you're hopping around, and then, so you met Nick. So this is probably a good time to get to Nick.
All right. I'm all hopped up on my caffeine. I'm ready to go.
So, Nick.
Yes.
Where are you born? What did your parents do?
I'm born in Long Island, New York. I have lived in or around that area for pretty much my entire life. Outside of a short stint over in London.
What, Ronkonkoma?
No, Massapequa.
Got it.
I'm on the South Shore. Jerry Seinfeld, Alec Baldwin,
yeah.
Those guys. Yeah, so my dad, he was a banker. He worked at Deutsche Bank for quite some time, probably close to 30 years. And my mom, she basically just took care of me and my siblings. She actually teaches yoga now to children at hospitals.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
Yep.
So, did any of your dad's banking rub off on you? Did you go to work with him?
Quite the opposite, actually. So, growing up, you know, my dad was the type of person that he did not like his job.
And yet he did it.
And yet he did it. He did the commute in and out for at least 30 years. Did not like his job. And I always kind of saw that and thought, you know, you got to weigh the pros and cons. You know, he made good money, but it didn't seem like he was necessarily happy at his work life. And I knew that I didn't want to grow up to have a job that I would be stressing, you know, big time in that kind of way, the way he did.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So, what was the first hustle that you had?
Good question. So, you know, Todd's got a little bit more of a, let's call it a purebred entrepreneur background. I was more of like
I give him 72-1 odds. I'm betting on this. I'm betting on these horses.
Yeah.
But no, much better than
that's
that.
Not to say, you know, when I was a kid, I was always the guy that was trading basketball cards. I was big into like the WWF action figures, and I would always find other kids that had their own collections, and I would just try to rip them off on trades.
Somebody literally beyond that. Somebody, I had these magic cards,
yep.
And I had some really good ones. Somebody said, he stole them from me.
Yeah. No, I always knew the value of the toys and the cards that I had, and would always just try to, you know, trade that into something more valuable.
Yeah.
So I'd be on the bus doing this, you know, making deals with kids before school.
Love it. What'd you do next as far as businesses go?
As far as business, this is actually my first foray into starting my own real business.
Yeah, but let's find something chronologically, you know, how.
Sure. So yeah, like, you want to jump down here?
You what? They don't let you smoke?
No. Oh.
In the park?
Nope.
Okay, we'll walk on the street.
And so I get my ass fined.
I can't believe you can't smoke in Central Park.
Nope.
Like, can you smoke cigarettes?
Nope.
That is so weird.
This is what I was looking forward to, is going into the park. And now we can't do it.
Good. You're going to ruin your day.
Why do I partner with you? You know, jumping back into my early days in like high school, I was always the one persuading people to do things that were maybe a little bit out of their comfort zone.
Uh-huh.
So I do have a little bit of that sales background. And one of the big examples I always like to use for that is growing up, a couple of my friends and I, we would play tennis after school. It was only a few of us, maybe like four or five. And we always had the best time. And I tried to tell a bunch of my other friends that they should join in. And they were all like, oh, tennis is so lame. We don't want to play that. That's like not for us. Uh-huh. And I was like, you guys should come out. Like, it'll be fun. And I eventually built this tournament within the town that got up to about 40 guys at the high school. They all collectively show up and play against each other. And we recorded the whole thing and made it into a DVD documentary that eventually spread throughout the school.
Yeah.
And was shown in all of like the different classes, to the point where kids that I didn't even know were coming up being like, can I get that DVD from you guys? Like, it was really funny. And it just became like the talk of the town, at least in our eye.
Now, why didn't you get any sponsors for the tennis tournament and turn it into something?
You know, if I had done this today, I would have thought of doing that. Yeah. But I was a dumb 17-year-old kid that just, you know, was able to convince people that this was a good idea. And I kind of left it at that.
So you like being the leader of something cool?
Yeah, I like organizing things and trying to get people to do things that maybe they normally wouldn't do otherwise. And I'll give you one more quick example. Maybe a little bit later, I guess in my college years, a bunch of friends and I, we were talking about going skydiving. There was about eight of us, and I had gone before multiple times, but all my other friends hadn't. And there were a couple of my friends that pretty much said they would never, ever do it. And I said to them, is there a 0% chance you would do this? And they're like, not zero. And that's kind of my mindset, is that if somebody doesn't say there's no chance of them doing something, I will look for any kind of way to convince them to do what I think they should do.
So forget about Joe Rogan. You should have been on Fear Factor.
Yes. Oh, I would love to be on that show. But ultimately, I was able to convince two friends in particular who said they would never do it to actually go skydiving. And they loved it. So that, I guess, is maybe a little bit of a way to illustrate my salesmanship in a way.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm really getting a real Ocean's 11 kind of vibe.
Sure. Yeah, we could say that.
You go to college, what'd you study?
I was a sports management major. Went to Seton Hall, which is in South Orange, New Jersey.
They got a big basketball team.
Yes. That's actually one of the main reasons I opted to go there, because at the time sports was a big part of my life. Still is to an extent, but not quite as much. And yeah, love the basketball team there. During college, I would say, so I had a few different internships. One of them was working at Madison Square Garden.
There you
go. I always wanted to work for the Knicks. I did advertising sales there, but I didn't really like how they ran the company. And that was
What didn't you like? And was this with the current owner?
It was with the current owner.
Got it. Enough said.
Yeah, so you can kind of figure that one out. But yeah, it's just they didn't give me as much responsibility as I had hoped for. But
so
yeah,
you felt like you were spinning your wheels a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
And there wasn't enough autonomy, and it was just boring.
It was boring aside from being able to go see free Knicks games, which
yes.
I was pretty pumped about.
They still lost.
yeah.
I'm still a Knicks fan. I mean, I've got no other choice.
20 years and counting of losing seasons. It's miserable. Yeah, so not really too much that I can draw from during my college years that would relate necessarily to starting a business. But after I graduated college, I began working for the New York Mets.
There you go. Are you a fan or are you a Yankees guy?
I am not really a baseball fan.
Yeah.
So I kind of faked it until I made it, getting that job, sort of pretended like I was a baseball fan, and then got my foot in the door working for the sales team there, selling season ticket packages and different kind of like group packages to get people out at the stadium.
So you're probably selling to businesses.
In this case, it was actually more towards just regular fans that had gone to games in previous seasons. But this is sort of where my real love for sales, I guess, truly started, because I would go into the office there and make 120 cold calls every day. just trying to get people to come out to Citi Field. And at the time, Citi Field was brand new. It was only the second year that it was open. Ended up being, you know, one of the top performers on the team there, and found that I was good at it. Just not only convincing people to do things like, you know, playing tennis or whatever, but convincing people to buy tickets and actually spend money really just over the phone.
Yeah.
I found that I was good at that.
So did anything ever progress? Was it always a cold call situation, or did you sort of build up a reputation where you weren't just doing cold calls anymore, you're doing some more elaborate kind of things?
For that particular position, it was mostly cold calls.
It's amazing.
we would also have, you know, the tables set up during home games and sell to people in person.
I think it's a lot more fun than sitting at a desk.
Definitely. So that was always enjoyable, just because you can actually get to know what the person is really like. But anyway, that was a ton of fun. Found that I was good at it. From there, I started working for a ticket broker company in the city. They sold tickets to sporting events, concerts, theater.
Not SeatGeek.
This was more an independent ticket broker company.
Was this before SeatGeek existed?
It was.
Got it.
This was around 2011. Yeah, I had worked on the customer service team there and eventually worked my way up to be a supervisor on the team there and managed a team of about 10 people.
So what do you, like, being a manager,
yep.
You weren't doing any of the day-to-day work. Was it boring being a manager?
No, I actually liked it a lot more.
Yeah.
Because the day-to-day work just became tedious, and when I was able to actually oversee an entire team, the problems I encountered on a regular basis would change, and that forced me to stay on my toes.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I always think back to is, at the time, I was only about 23 years old, and I was managing people that were in their 50s and 60s.
That's incredible.
So you had to find a balance of being able to communicate the things that they needed to learn how to do, but also not offend them.
Right, because they're like, who's this young little 23-year-old, you know,
exactly,
trying to tell me what to do?
Right. So you gotta, you have to find a balance of how to teach things to people that are older than you, I think. But I learned a lot from that. And from there, that's when I started working at Cater to Me, which is the corporate catering service that Todd and I connected at.
Now, what were you doing there? So you'd already been a manager. How old were you when you went to Cater to Me?
It's about 27, I think.
Yeah. So a little bit more experience. And,
yep.
And what was your function there?
So working there, it was more sales. I was going out and chatting with different companies, trying to get them to order through us to provide food to their team on a regular basis.
Yes.
So, you know, this is targeting companies that are anywhere from like 20 to 250 people that eat lunch in their office every day.
Yes.
So yeah, it was constantly sourcing leads and figuring out who would have a need for our service.
So you said you had an interesting story about how you met Todd. Let's get into that.
I actually interviewed Todd.
Uh-huh.
What'd
you think of him?
I had some mixed feelings.
It was an hire on the spot.
I don't like saying this because it really boosts Todd's ego a little bit. But I will say, after I interviewed him, I always remember, I walked out and I looked at my manager at the time and I just gave him the big thumbs up.
Uh-huh.
And after that, Todd was hired and we started to work really well together. If you can't tell from this interview, we have very different approaches to the way we talk to people and the way we just sell in general.
So he's the good cop and you're the bad cop.
I would flip that around.
I know.
we really complimented each other well. Todd is great at getting people to sign up for things like a Cater to Me service on the in person, on the spot. Whereas I was more a little bit maybe meticulous.
You're the closer.
In a way, sometimes, depends. But I was more working the phones and figuring out how to kind of cast a wide net and find as many potential fits as possible through like email campaigns and using the phone. Whereas Todd would be out on the street a lot of the time, almost all the time, selling face to face.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he said he only worked there for 10 months.
Yeah, he left me. He abandoned me. I stuck around. I was there for about a little over 2.5 years. it had reached the point where I felt like I had kind of maxed out. Couldn't really move up the ladder too much anymore. And during that time, towards the end, I had come up with the idea for App. And once it started to pick up a little bit of momentum in terms of like, oh, I should really start doing this.
Okay, so.
Yes.
Perfect transition. We're actually 10 minutes ahead of schedule.
Cool.
This is perfect. What was the early idea of App?
Yeah, so.
And how many years ago are we talking?
This is March of 2017, roughly around that time. Yeah, about two years ago. This is something that I had almost just thought of like out of nowhere in a lot of ways. I had been using an app called Hooch, which—
Never heard of it.
Yeah, they basically do complimentary drinks at a lot of bars in the city.
Yes.
I had been using it, loved it, thought it was a great idea. And then I started to think, this would be really cool if there was a version of this, but for food. And I started to think, I did a little research and I found that there was nothing out there that existed already that was doing this. So I kept tossing the idea back and forth between all different friends and family. Eventually got to Todd and tossed the idea by him. This went on for months where I was just that annoying guy that was like, yo, what do you think of this? Like, uh-huh. Is this, do you think this will work? And eventually one of my friends, he was like, Nick, you haven't shut up about this for the last 4 months. Like, Either do something about it or stop talking about it. And that's really kind of what gave me the kick in the butt to start taking this seriously. And at that time, when I decided, all right, I'm gonna go for this, that's when I remembered, hey, Todd has run businesses before. Unfortunately, I actually kind of like him. Maybe I'll go and see what he thinks of this.
So he comes to you, and what was the, how did that go?
I originally charged him $3,500 a minute for my... Nick and I have debated this specific point multiple times. He's wrong, but he's allowed to be wrong now and then. He came to me with the concept really, really early. And I was like, that's a really cool concept. You should do something with that. And then it steadily, yeah, I like that.
We hit the 30-minute mark.
Sweet.
He came to me with the idea like really, really, really long time ago. Probably like right, I'd say like right around the original times he was thinking about it, because I was still like catered to me. And he's like, hey, I have this weird idea. What do you think? And I'm like, that's a really cool idea. You should do something with that. And that was it.
Uh-huh.
Didn't hear anything for a long time. Then he comes to me, and now I'm in my whole consulting swing and everything like that. And he's like, hey, I've been making some moves. I've been doing some stuff. Can you give me some advice? Sat down. He's like, I have no clue what my next steps are. So I remember sitting down in Washington Square Park. We chatted about it for a little bit. I'm like, hey, how about you and me, we meet up at my house and go into a lot more detail. Came over to my house, really just laid out a plan of what to do next. Part of that plan was him saying, do you want to jump on board? Because he could really use, extra set of hand.
What were you doing before Todd came on board?
Excellent question. So I was basically doing everything I could do without Todd's help.
So talk, literally give me a story of like the first restaurant you went to, how the pitch went, how many restaurants said no way, and like let's get into that.
Yep, so before I even started to think about whether this could be an app, I had been living in Hell's Kitchen and sat on the idea for a long time and eventually was like, you know what, I'm gonna hit the street right now and just chat with restaurant owners to see if they'd be open to this concept.
Now restaurant owners are really tough to get a hold of.
Yes.
Because they're typically there on the weekends, but in the weekends is their busiest time, so.
Right, and they don't respond to emails.
Or phone calls.
Or phone calls, so you basically have to catch them in person.
Yeah.
At the time, they don't want to be around when they say to come visit.
That's true, yeah, you'll get stood up sometimes.
I get stood up for the show all the time.
So in those early days, I would almost wait until it was like raining outside, and I knew it wouldn't be as busy in restaurants, and then I would just make my way up and down 9th Avenue and pop into restaurants and say, hey, if I went out into the city right now and told everyone that I came in contact with to come to your restaurant and you didn't have to pay me anything, would you be willing to give those people I send to you something small on your menu?
Now that's a great refined sales pitch right there. I'm sure it took you a little while to get to that.
I actually started with that and then abandoned it for a little bit, and now I've revisited it again.
Well,
because
I love it.
Yeah.
And how do they react?
So some of them were like, nope, we don't need that. We're totally fine. We have our usual customers.
And then they went out of business in 6 months.
Correct.
Because New York City restaurants, first of all, the restaurant industry in general, you know, we're talking more than 50% of restaurants fail in the first year. But New York City is just that on steroids. It's like hyper that. Rent is so high here. This is a real gastronomic town.
But anyway, I would jump into all these different restaurants. Like I said, some would say no, but then I found that others were like, that sounds like a decent idea. I think I would give that a shot. So I had about, you know, 5 or 6 different places all in my immediate neighborhood that were at least open to this concept. And once I got that, you know, positive affirmation, I said, okay, I have to take the next step now.
What was the next step?
And the next step from that was figuring out how to develop this into a functional app.
So did you start developing it before Todd came on board?
Yes. So
You paid a guy?
Yes. Yeah, I hired a team out in San Diego to help put together a test version of what the app would look like. We designed the whole thing, got that ready to go, and then I was able to use that as a sales tool, basically, when I would go to restaurants and say, hey, this is what this is going to look like, and this is what the concept is. What do you think of it?
Uh-huh.
Was able to get a few more restaurants that said, hey, this sounds like a good idea. Let me know when you're actually up and running. And then at that point, that's when Todd and I connected and started really getting the ball rolling on building this into something usable.
So talk about the first restaurant, both of you, whoever wants to chime in, talk about the first restaurant that actually signed up, and how did that go? You don't have to name names, but just...
No, I'll name the name because we love working with them. It's Alla Turca. They're a Turkish restaurant on the Upper East Side. They have belly dancing every Thursday. It gets kind of wild there. But I had sent a huge email blast out to all different restaurants. I was basically going to their websites, getting the emails, and then just tossing them into, you know, an email sequence. They got back to me and they said, hey, we're down with this. Like, what do we have to do? And that's when I went in and I said, hey, all you need to do is select a few appetizers, sides, desserts, whatever it is you want to feature, and let us put that on the app. And that's what people can redeem when they go and eat there.
So, and you're paying for it? Or?
So, yeah, restaurants don't get charged. We don't take anything from them at all. And we don't pay for the appetizers. So when one of our users goes to the restaurant, they sit down, they have to order more. They can't just go in and get their free thing and leave.
So it's on the restaurant to enforce that?
Correct, yeah. So the only cost to the restaurant is the cost to provide whatever appetizer they want to have featured with us. And then on the flip side, just to give you a clearer picture of what our business model is, it's a subscription app. So
you decided later to charge?
Charging users. So users spend $10 a month, and then they can get up to one appetizer on the house every single day.
One appetizer per restaurant. So can I go to one?
No. If you say you really like a restaurant, let's say you love Alla Turca, right? And you live right across the street, and you go there 4 days a week. You can get a complimentary appetizer every time you go, every day, once per day.
But can I go to Alla Turca, like, and then for one meal, and then like for dinner, can I go to another restaurant?
Right now, the complimentary appetizers are limited to one per day.
Got it.
So it'd be, you know, you can get up to 30 complimentary appetizers. It's within a 1 day block, not a 24-hour period. So like, say you went to dinner, a late dinner, and then like, bell tolls at 2:30 a.m. You're at one of the bars and you want to get an appetizer, you can actually get one.
Okay, cool. Let's go to the growth in like the second restaurant and the third restaurant. And how does this story unfold? That's the supply side, the demand side. How did you grow the customers? Did you just put the app on the app store? You know, were people using it at first? Like, how did that go?
So we did our first release of our MVP at Tech Day last year, not this pet one, the previous one. And when we first launched, it was subscription only. And not only was it subscription only, you couldn't even see what restaurants existed on the app unless you were subscribed.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of people like sign up and give emails and stuff like that. But like no one subscribed because they didn't know what restaurants existed.
Right.
So we had to like go back to the drawing board and start to really hash down all right, we really focused so much on what the restaurants need that we kind of ignored a whole bunch of stuff about what the users need. And a lot of this past year has been heavily focusing on revamping what the app looks like and what the experience for the user looks like as well. App is free to use until September. So if you download it, all you have to do is register with an email or Facebook, and you get a free appetizer once per day, every day at any of the partner restaurants. Nothing else is needed, no credit card information. And then when we release the new version in September, we wanted to create a way you can see all the restaurants ahead of time, get a full experience, and try out the app a little bit. So what we ended up doing, and will come live in September, is we're gonna be a freemium model where you can get a complimentary appetizer 3 times per month, free. No card required, nothing, just use.
Love it.
If you like it and you find that you go out more often, there's a lot of restaurants you like on there, for $10 a month, you can upgrade to get it one per day. And as we add additional features to the app, those would be more on the premium end. So, you know, it just makes the premium package look a lot nicer for those people who commit to us.
So sell me on some of the great restaurants that you've got.
You want me to take that one?
Go for it.
I'm the restaurant guy.
I'm a big food guy.
Yeah, so we've got a ton of restaurants that I'm really excited about.
Sensakana,
yeah, that's always the first one I say.
It sounds Japanese? Or?
It's Japanese meets Peruvian.
Oh, yeah, now we're talking. Where's this?
It's a Midtown restaurant. It's on, 45th or 46th? Something like that,
yeah.
In between,
yeah.
5th and 6th Avenue.
This sounds really good.
Todd and I have both gone there multiple times. They have incredible food, and
cocktails.
Yeah, the cocktails there are amazing.
Ceviches.
Yeah, dude, I think so.
Best California roll. Well, one of the best California rolls in the city, because they actually use real snow crab, not that fake shit.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
I love it.
So that place is, it's super trendy. It's got like a really, I don't know, you just have to see the inside. You walk in and you feel like you're in a special kind of place.
So that's one of the things about really the New York City or LA or restaurants in general, but in big cities, restaurants are like, they invest so much, and this is part of the reason why they maybe fail. Is they invest so much in their ambiance. You know, we're talking a build out of $200,000, I would imagine, easily for a place like that. You know, they're practically movie sets. And a good, smart restaurant will use their restaurant as a movie set.
Yes.
Especially here in New York City. I just wanted to show off that fact.
I'm going to jump into other restaurants.
It is the type of place that could be in a film, for sure.
Two other spots that come to mind off the top of my head.
What do you got?
Le Rivage.
Le Rivage.
On Restaurant Row. Amazing French bistro. They actually won Best Burger in New York City for the French Onion Soup Burger.
Ooh,
fantastic place.
It's a soup burger?
Yeah, it's got the onion, the melted cheese, like all that stuff on a brioche bun.
Oh, brioche.
Dude, it's heavenly. Absolutely heavenly.
That's a time-tested restaurant, too.
Yeah.
They're one of the original Restaurant Row restaurants over there.
When you say Restaurant Row, you mean what's...
That's on 46th Street in between 8th and 9th.
Oh, so really Broadway.
Yes, they're big with the theater crowd.
Yes.
And another one, Charrua. Which is an Uruguayan restaurant. I love South American food.
Yeah, where is this?
It's in Lower East Side.
Lower East Side's a very trendy area.
Dude, their steak there is to die for. Absolutely to die for. Fantastic ambiance. I like it because it's nice open, like window style. So like on a beautiful day, everything's open. You can sit outside, you can sit in front. It's a fantastic place. Amazing food.
I got a restaurant for you. I've been tracking them for 2 years. And they're in the Lower East Side, and they were on Vice, and they blew up, but they weren't hitting it as a restaurant. Their business, something was off with their business model or whatever, because for like a year, even being featured on television, they had no traffic. Like I would go in, the food was, it's Italian, it's Roman street food, it's like on Orchard, and I'm not having a good name day, but the food's amazing, and now I went back, and now they're popping.
Good.
So
it's always good to hear.
Yeah, I mean the food is so good. I'm like this can't fail. I don't want. And
food is what's sad is like so. There's lots of restaurants with amazing food that doesn't prevent you from failing by any stretch of the imagination. Tons of places with amazing food close up every day.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And you know it's. Maybe one of the business partner, you know, they're having a bad business relationship, A, or B, maybe they're in a bad location.
So there's a lot of factors that play into it.
but
I'm gonna throw one more restaurant in there also. Obika mozzarella bar. They are something else. They have actually 24 different locations all over the world.
Oh, so you've
they're
already
international.
So you've already, all right, so you're getting,
we're only in New York, we don't have all 24.
Yeah, we don't have all 24, not yet. We have their location in Flatiron, and then they have another spot in
Madison.
Yeah,
up north.
But yeah, that place is amazing for pizza, pasta, and you can get complimentary fresh mozzarella balls over there, which I've had, and they're delicious.
You've been focusing on the users, and you just recently did a public crowdfunder.
So, yeah.
Which, full disclosure, I participated in.
Thank you.
And so what that tells me is some kind of signal that you have some degree of confidence that you want to go, you know, double down, triple down, you know, on this. And why'd you do that? Why'd you go the crowdfunding route? I'm just curious.
Great question. So in the game of fundraising, one of the things we're learning is the more people you know, the better your chances are. And the more people you know with money, the better your chances are. Let's throw it that way. As a non-New York native, I don't know a ton of people. Again, Nick's network is limited in that as well. So like while we're still building up that network, we need money to continue operations while we're building out everything and doing a lot of the testing. Basically, I looked for a lot of different options of like what exists. You know, you go to meetings all day, you go to like talks with angels. And a good friend of mine was like, hey, did you ever look into crowdfunding? And I'm like, it sounds great. I know people who've done like Kickstarter and GoFundMe. And he's like, no. You want to look at equity crowdfunding, because let's be real, apps don't do well on normal crowdfunding platforms. I mean, what are you going to say? I'll let you download app if you give me $30. It's free on the App Store.
Are you contractually prevented from doing Kickstarter?
No.
From doing so you, because Kickstarter is a great way to get free marketing. Why not just put it on Kickstarter and say, you know, you'll get 10 free appetizers for, you know, $50. Anyway, just an idea.
The one big issue you run into that is like Kickstarter as a perk pool is a huge market in the terms of like, there's people who are in California, Nevada, the whole bunch of locations that we could never offer really much of anything to.
So you're really focusing on New York.
So, but
now,
the benefit with an equity crowdfund like we have on WeFunder is you're not like, it's not anything where if you invest $100, by the way, big difference between equity crowdfunding and normal crowdfunding is you're donating with hope of a perk back for a normal one. With a WeFunder, you're investing where you get equity. That is the big difference between the two. So giving something to app if you're in Nevada, you know, investing in app in your Nevada is just your way of exposing yourself to being able to invest in early startups, and now you own part of it.
So how is the crowdfunding going? Are you getting demand from cities outside of New York from people you don't know?
So we're absolutely getting some investors from non-New Yorkers. We've definitely had a handful of them. What's really funny is like some people have actually recently found us that are non-New Yorkers and are asking us when we're expanding out, which was great. I had Nick do a quick test practice with restaurants in Phoenix because he had a couple people in Phoenix message us on our support and like, oh, how come the app's not working? I'm like, oh, you have to turn on location services. Oh, I did that. Still don't see anything. I'm like, are you in New York City? Like, oh no, we're in Phoenix.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, that's why you don't see any restaurants. We're not in Phoenix.
So when do you think you're going to expand?
The big one for us right now is launching our new version in September and really just getting you more users on board. As we start to get a little bit more traction with that, then looking at other cities down the road, we're probably targeting Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. first. They're closer, easier for us to get to and on board as well.
How are you going to scale this in the next 12 months?
Great question.
And just, you know, I don't mean geographically, I just mean growth-wise, user-wise.
Yeah, so right now with the restaurant end, we're working with a whole slew of people in the restaurant industry, starting up partnerships with like other entities who provide services to restaurants to try to just get more restaurants on board, get in front of more restaurants.
Food influencers on Instagram.
Yep.
Now, how are the food influencers? Because influencers typically, if they're at a certain scale, they're like, they'll say, okay, yeah, you can have my services for $7,500 a minute. You know, they put out these insane offers.
Yeah, I don't work with those. Right now, so what we ended up doing for some of the food influencers is we have a specific package where if they make warm intros to restaurants for us, if Nick closes them, we give them a payout.
There you go.
So all they have to do is, you know, all these restaurants that they're talking to constantly, they can provide, you know, just a warm intro. I don't need them to close. I don't need to do anything. I just need to have them get Nick in front, and then Nick can close them from there. So we're leveraging that as well as, again, other people in the industries. On the user end, right now, the big change we did from the last tech day was just make app free for users right now, just to drive a little bit more traffic on the user end, which actually panned out so far pretty good. We saw a 263% increase in new user signups, registrations, not downloads, actual registrations. And we saw a 280% increase in unique appetizer redemptions. When I mean unique, I mean unique users. So if you went and did like three in that month, you're still kind of one unique user.
I don't think it's a great idea, but have you done any Instagram advertising?
We did mess around with it a little bit, you know, just a couple things here and there.
It's a waste of money, by the way.
I'm not gonna argue that. I believe at this stage it's probably not the most effective. But for like small things to test out, you know, like $50, $75,
sure.
Here's fine.
I mean, I know the customer acquisition cost for this podcast is $15 a customer. And, you know, that means I, to get to where I want to be, I need to invest $500,000, which I'm not going to do for this.
That's a lot.
What's your customer acquisition cost? Putting you on the spot now.
Fantastic. So far, so a lot of our customer acquisition right now has been two things. One, we talk to people. And two, we've run events at our partner restaurants where people sign up and get a free appetizer right then and there. And a lot of restaurants like that because it's a cool free perk right off the bat. And it lets people know that every time they come back and keep coming back, they can get cool perks as well.
That's the big difference that we feel we have compared to a lot of these other apps out there is we encourage people to go to the same restaurants over and over if they've found a spot that they really like.
Yeah.
A lot of the other apps out there are more about discovery, which we are too, but they incentivize people to go to different spots more than, you know, if you're happy with one place, you can theoretically go there as many times as you want. So we have a combo of being able to, you know, explore and go to different spots as much as you want, but also just repeat the same place if you really like it.
Now, is it just you two guys on the team?
Yes, and intermittent interns.
Is the tech still being done in San Diego?
We actually have a guy we work with out of WeWork Labs in Dumbo, a good friend of ours.
And did he take equity or are you paying him?
Both.
Fantastic. Is your app available iOS, Android?
Right now it's only available on iOS. We were on Android for a little bit, but it'll be back on there in September.
Yeah. Oh, pretty quickly if it justifies, you know, maintaining the Android app. Like if it's 50-50 or... You know, but
so what's really unique with the tech stack, we use Ionic. So it's similar in the sense that it can work on both platforms. The reason we're not on Google right now is in our original code set for MVP, a lot of the SMS stuff was run straight through our code and they want us to use a third-party platform.
Yeah, these are the kind of scalability issues that, because like going to Android is more than just running two platforms. You might, like, just to let you know a little bit about my background, I've helped build a social network. We're talking multi-million dollar project, and scaling to Android is more than just like a 1x cost.
Yeah.
As you're finding out with messaging, and so just be real careful about that. Like, I think there's a lot more room for growth that you have just on iOS.
Yeah.
But if you're seeing, you know, like 50% of your traffic on Android, maybe it is worth doing Android at the same time.
15% of our traffic used Android. So that's why we figured not having to throw a whole bunch of development costs into the Android end and just letting it shift out to September when a lot of those things that we needed to fix have to be fixed anyways. So they're compliant with a lot of Apple's new regulations as well.
So I'm not too up to date. What's Apple making you do now?
Oh, it's really just the utilizing SMS through third-party platforms.
Yeah.
Like Twilio or something.
Interesting. So Apple's breaking away from doing its own SMS.
It's not so much that it's not Apple doing their own SMS. It's more that, like, when I went, say you wanted to refer a friend, right?
Okay.
You right now the code that accesses your SMS is within our ship, right?
Yeah.
For security purposes, they don't want that anymore, is what we're running into. They want you to use a more secure third-party platform that accesses all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's really what the big issue is in. So like we have a handful of extra changes we needed to make it more compliant with Android, while we were able to fix the ones for iOS, which was a much higher priority since roughly 90% of our users were iOS.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the Android one.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of value in just proving out your model.
Yeah.
It could easily kill a company to, you know, go broader than you need to go before your model is and you know your everything is fully scaled out.
And a fun story about the whole Android versus iOS thing. I remember when I had to do a test for something on Android, and I was at the WeWork. We were at the WeWork Labs in Dumbo. I had to run up and talk to everyone I could see, 6 different floors until I found one person with an Android phone.
Yeah.
Everyone had iOS. I'm like, well, this is actually really difficult.
So I think it's demographics, right? I think it's sort of a per capita thing. It's like if you make more than 50 grand a year, you probably
have an iPhone.
Apple. Although these days, Apple is definitely going down a little bit.
Their prices haven't.
Right
now, it's like if you make 250 grand, you can afford the new iPhone.
No, that's intentional. That's intentional. You know, when Apple launched, they were a high market item, right?
Yeah.
$500, and then they sort of went a little min market. But in countries like China, Apple, you know, like the Xiaomi phone is like $1,500. You know, $2,000.
Yeah.
So Apple wants to compete on that too, because it costs a lot of money to build out all those features. And so yeah, anyway, back to App. You guys are going strong. How long are you prepared to run this?
You mean the company as a whole?
Yeah.
Until I IPO and can buy everybody. Yo, so I've told Nick this before. One of my biggest pet peeves with anyone who builds a company is they're building something to get bought and not building something to build.
Exactly.
I'm not building to get bought. If some company finds us down the road and says, yo, we'll give you $950 million, I'll have the conversation. But my end game goal is always the same. It's I want to IPO. I don't want to be the guy who gets bought.
Uh-huh.
I want to be the guy who buys.
What are you going to do to make sure that happens?
Well, right now it's to get more restaurants, which is our primary focus, even over users.
But interesting.
Well, think of it this way. So the app itself has a natural network effect. If I have 20 restaurants, you're less likely to use it. If I have 400 restaurants, value is much higher. Well, if I have 400 restaurants, not only is the value high for you, it's high for your friends, it's high for everybody else. So then you'll start to attract more users, which allows us to eventually attract more restaurants. You know, it's like one of those things that naturally can build upon itself when you get to a specific scale. But I believe that building out your supply end first is the most important part.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine like, you know, if you're an Uber with 25 cars,
right,
you can only get so many people. But you know, the moment I have 10,000 cars, welcome to New York City, I have everybody. So we're just looking to build out our restaurant base, and that's our main focus. We're not doing it at the complete loss of users. You know, we're doing other things to bring users, but our main focus right now is restaurants.
Well, I really like the food Instagrammer, because I think it's a much better use of marketing dollars than paying Instagram.
Oh, we're definitely looking at influencers as a whole. We're starting with food influencers because it makes sense. There's a lot of people who love going to restaurants who don't follow food influencers, but they do other things. You know what I mean? They follow other influencers out there. So our next goal is to target, who are those other influencers? What are our ideal users following? And then reaching out to those as well.
So in wrapping this up, this is my final question. I ask it to everybody now. So this is like the main question, I think. Because this show is all about your story, your guys' story as entrepreneurs. And yes, we got into the day-to-day of your business. But what I want to know, and I want both of you to answer in time, is how do you think you've grown as an entrepreneur?
Like I mentioned before, this is my first time really building my own business. So learning the day-to-day and dealing with the ups and downs that come with all of that is something that I really value. You know, when I started this whole thing, obviously I want this to be super successful, but my mindset was I need to try this idea out because so many people have said you gotta go for it. And no matter what the end result is, as long as I have something that I can take from the experience itself, then this has been a success. With that said, I want this to blow up. I think, you know, 2 years later, I still think it's a great idea. And how I've grown, I mean, really just understanding, you know, the time that it takes to build something like this. It requires hustle and grind every single day. I'm on the street literally every day, just talking to restaurant owners and managers, and this has been going on for 2 years now. These types of things, they don't happen overnight. You have to put the work in. And that's something that when I started this, maybe I wasn't fully aware of, but I'm glad that I understand that now. And I'm super pumped every single day to wake up and continue building this out.
So, Todd, how do you think, in what ways have you grown as an entrepreneur?
I've been doing this for a lot longer of a time. So for me, it's just been a steady grind of ups and downs. A lot of the things that I feel I've learned, which I think are very, very imperative in any form of success as an entrepreneur, is learning how to ground yourself. And however that works for people is great. My grounding forces me to relax for 2 hours, clears my head. If you can't learn how to clear your head, the downs will kill you. I am not kidding, the downs will kill you. One of the biggest things I always try to explain to people, and I remember when I was talking to Nick about it as well, is while the highs are great, the lows are really low.
Yes.
The lows are incredibly low. So having a good network, I learned over time, was imperative. I have a really strong network of people I can call up if I'm having trouble. For anyone interested, yo, it's cool to cry. I can't tell you how many times I buried myself in a pillow, thought I was gonna fucking fail. I cried myself to sleep, and you just wake up, clear your mindset, and go back at it. Because while everything might go wrong, it's on you to turn it back around. That's probably the biggest lesson I've ever learned.
There you go, guys. It's on you. So go check out App. How do you spell the link?
It's if you just go on the iOS store, APP, no space, no nothing, you'll see it. We're a nice little orange logo with an A and a fork in it. Download it, register, get your free appetizer.
New York City only for now.
For now.
Hopefully by the time somebody in the future sees this, you'll be in other cities.
We'll be in all the cities.
So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap.